From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, we are rebroadcasting our special hour on video games. Seemingly in celebration of the occasion, the Supreme Court, a huge OTM fan, struck down a California law that would have levied fines against retailers who sold violent games to minors. That happened on Monday. Speaking for the court, Justice Antonin Scalia wrote that the basic principles of freedom of speech do not vary with a new and different communications medium. Maybe you think video games are mostly about murder and mayhem. Judging by sales, probably they are. But they're also about blazing new trails in technology and art. And I assure you, they are changing how you live, whether or not you play. After this hour, you'll know why. But first, some history. That starts, says New York Times Magazine writer and game aficionado Clive Thompson, with a simple tennis game invented by Atari co-founder Nolan Bushnell called Pong.
He put it in this thing called Andy Capp's Saloon in a bar, and he got a call a day later saying, the machine's broken, come fix it. And what had happened was that so many quarters were jammed in the slot, it was stuck. He knew right away, wow, this is clearly a compelling activity for people to do. It was the first time that the average person sat down and used some sort of controls, in this case a little spinning knob, to affect what was happening on the screen and to have a kind of a meaningful and fun experience. You got to remember...
Meaningful?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, in the sense that any game is meaningful. You know, it's part of how we challenge ourselves, we challenge other people. And it illustrated something that computers can do really well, which is to let people sort of play with physics. Because that's all Pong was. Like, wow, if I try and put some real English on this ball, what do I get? And that was something that was very common in those early video games. Pac-Man and Space Invaders and Pong were almost like looking directly into the soul of the machine. Those games are what computers think about when we're not around, basically.
We always say that arcade games came first, but I would argue that the home game actually preceded the arcade game if you count Winky Dink. That was a TV show that debuted in October of 1953.
Winky Dink. And you, Winky Dink, and me always have the last.
What you do is you place a clear piece of plastic that came in a kit across the TV screen, and you connected the dots to create a bridge for this character, Winky Dink, to cross to safety. So that not only makes Winky Dink the first video game, but the first interactive video game, and it started in your house.
Winky Dink was like, wow, you know, this thing is in our house. It's kind of uncanny. It's got these moving pictures on it. What happened if we touched it? You couldn't actually affect what was happening on the screen. If you drew the bridge incorrectly, the character would not fall, right? And so the next step was really for the video game to come along and say, you're going to interact with what's on screen, and it's going to change based on what you do. I think this is what trained us for the explosion of computers in our everyday lives.
Right, and what enabled us to be comfortable with doing that? The mouse.
People forget this, but the mouse was an incredibly complicated thing for people to wrap their heads around when it first came out. It really did feel like there was this disembodied thing happening because you're not looking at your hands off to one side and you're moving it and this little pointer's moving on screen. That's so normal to us now, but the first time anyone does it, it's very, very weird and unsettling and actually hard. And so one of the smartest things that Microsoft ever did, they put Solitaire on all versions of Windows. And it sort of trained them on how to use the mouse because they would click and drag a card over and lift the button up. Once you mastered using the mouse as Solitaire, you were ready to go on to use things like word processors and spreadsheets. I cannot tell you how many people I've talked to that have said that's what got them past the hump back in the early 80s. The mouse completely flustered them. They played Solitaire for 5 hours and bang, they were in there with the machine.
Also, in the 1980s, we saw Nintendo create the famous Game Boy. Did you have one?
I did. I remember when I got it, I was so excited because there was this idea that, wow, I can play these games anywhere now. You know, I don't have to be in front of a TV. It had a little screen. It had sound. When you look back at it now, what's amazing is this is the first time ever that a lot of people, again, mostly young boys, although a lot of young girls too, were carrying around a personal computer with them all day long. I mean, now, of course, we think that's completely normal. We have phones that are functional computers. We have iPads, laptops. But the first time in history that the average person just walked around with something that had a screen and really fast processing, was the Game Boy. When computers first came along, they were these important work machines, right? All they had to do was display black and white text and spreadsheets, and that's all the serious businessman needed. The first person that ever came along and said, no, there should be pretty pictures on screen, was the game makers. And so they went off and they basically built this huge billion-dollar industry trying to put beautiful pictures on screens. And then eventually the business people go, oh, wow, of course we need better ways to visualize our data. Thank you, video game industry, for inventing this for us. So if you don't have any Game Boy forcing screen makers to make better and better screens every year, finally they have color and they have backlighting and they have better resolution, you don't get the iPhone in the long run. The video game industry absolutely laid the seedbed for all the ways that we interact with data on screen right now.
It started in the arcade, then it landed in your hand. Contemporaneous with that, you had at least solitaire on your home computer. Then, in the early 90s, id Software popularized the infamous category of video games called first-person shooters. Not until id brought out Wolfenstein and Doom did they really catch on.
That's right. Instead of looking down on the action, you were in a first-person perspective. You were looking at things that looked to be 3D. You were looking down a hallway. You would move down the hallway. The halls would move past you.
Would you play with me right now?
Sure. Let's go play.
I haven't played this for a little while.
Previous games would make you feel very engaged, but this is the one that really made you feel, wow, I'm literally in this sort of almost Tron-like way inside the game itself. Obviously, that laid the bed for a lot of games that become increasingly immersive, where you're physically inside these beautiful worlds that can really feel like genuine alternate realities.
So, Clive, I wish that I could focus entirely on what you were saying. I'm busy
I know.
Killing Nazis. Somebody's shooting at me, but where? Where are they?
So I think the thing that these 3D games did has almost not even yet come to fruition in terms of its real impact. I would not be shocked if 10 years from now you've got glasses and heads-up displays. This idea that the world can have a 3D layer on top of it is going to become a very, very interesting thing. And it's going to be very familiar to people that spent their lives at that point in time growing up playing 3D immersive worlds where they ran around inside data, basically. Oh, I just got killed. My health went down to zero.
Let's go back to the studio.
I noticed, by the way, that you were really good at playing Wolfenstein. And had you ever played it before?
No, never.
So this is exactly what I'm talking about. If you tried playing it back then, you would have been horrible at it. But you've spent the intervening 20 years interacting with things that are essentially the children of video games. And so you've absorbed some good video game skills without even playing video games.
What was once a solitary enterprise that may have begun with solitaire becomes World of Warcraft, a massive cultural exchange across nations and across time.
Absolutely. When you go into World of Warcraft, everyone you see, most of the people, are real people, and they could be anywhere. I was on a reporting trip to China. I went into an internet cafe, and I saw these young Chinese soldiers in their uniforms, off duty, playing World of Warcraft, and they're wandering around in areas that I had been just myself about a week earlier. And I'm like, wow, I wonder if I ran into some of these Chinese soldiers when I was there last time. They form teams so that they can do even more audacious quests.
They can speak to each other.
They can speak to each other with voice or with text. The other thing that is really interesting about World of Warcraft is that you've got a meter that shows how strong you are, you've got a meter that shows what your next mission is, you've got a map showing where you're oriented, you've got a chat stream showing what other players are saying. There's an unbelievable amount of things you have to manage, and often in the heat of battle. But they make it really easy to do. Every tool is sort of around the edges of the screen, and it's very good at giving you little ambient cues, little dings and bits of noise to let you know when something is happening. So you really feel in control. And this is really one of the other things that video games have pioneered, which is how to put someone in a situation where they have an unbelievable amount of information and they have to manage it, and how to do it in a calm, graceful way. There's a lot of software over the last 10 years that has slowly been catching up to video games. If you're using a Mac, you'll notice that if you get a new instant message, your little icon on the bottom of the screen will just bounce up and down. Just very calmly letting you know, when you're free, go check your instant messaging. Someone is messaging you. That is absolutely a type of information disclosure that was pioneered and perfected by video games years before.
So if the decade of the aughts was managing huge amounts of data to create and build a world and maintain yourself within it, if that's what happened in the earlier part of this past decade, What accounts for what's happened in the latter part of it? I'm talking about going beyond mice or joysticks to our whole bodies with the Wii or the new Microsoft Kinect.
The first company to do this was Nintendo with the Wii, where they basically said, you know, there's a certain generation of people that are never going to figure out these joysticks. These joysticks have like 18 buttons on it. There's no way you're handing that to my mother. So they said, well, what if you just had to swing your hand, and when you swung your hand, you swung a tennis racket?
Love 15.
And they, with that very smart idea, created the Wii controller, which has a little motion sensor. And so that's exactly what you do. You swing your hand and the racket swings. And Microsoft recently took that further, where they basically have something that just sprays invisible rays across your room, senses where your body is, and it lets you just wave your arm or move your head or stand up and sit down to control the game. But a bunch of hackers have said, well, no, I want to run my email and I want to run my web browsing and I want to run my computer using that. So they started hacking it. And sure enough, they figured out how to get the Microsoft Kinect to let them control their computers just with a wave of their hands. Now you can immediately see what the future is going to look like, right? You could be just standing in the middle of your kitchen and bringing up your email or bringing up the menu with a wave of your hands onto a local screen. You saw Tom Cruise doing that a little bit in Minority Report. I used to think, well, that seems a little far-fetched. But as usual, I was betting against technology, which is a bad thing to bet against. And it looks like this stuff is going to be coming down the pike within 5 years, if you ask me.
Clive, thank you so much.
Not at all.
New York Times Magazine writer and techno whiz Clive Thompson. Coming up, do you have to play to understand? Do you have to understand to play? Yes? Maybe? No. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need on the web at RWJF.org. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.